You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is very early in the morning, Sunday, the 23rd of August, 2026. A few days ago, I did a Daily Nationalist with Sven Longshanks on the question of the militarization of the Baltics. And the possibility of that being a flashpoint in future war. And I decided that I was going to stick with that topic and build a far more detailed analysis of all the issues involved. You know, I was looking through a few of the books on the Russo-Ukrainian War. Some of them well-meaning, some of them not so well-meaning. And all I can say to you is that, you know, you have to be a specialist to grasp the nuances of this. You can't just be interested in the topic and read a lot on it. It doesn't work that way. And even when some of these people make a good point, they're not quite sure why they're making a good point. And there really is no in-depth follow-up. It's most of them also, even some that are sympathetic to my side of things, are way too reliant on regime media for even for basic facts. Even their basic facts have been distorted beyond belief. My book stands alone, and I'm not a self-promoter. I don't have that capacity. That's a Jewish trait. I don't know how to do it, but in this case, I have to tell you, please, go buy my book. On the Russo-Ukrainian War on Amazon right presently, because it's saying what no one else is saying. Anyway, the dissolution of the Baltics, NATO's use of the Baltic states to widen the war against Russia, smaller allies and clients of a much larger power sometimes have points of leverage to drag greater powers into war. I mean, the obvious example is Israel and the U.S. We're seeing it again, Baltics and the Americans. May even be seeing it soon on the island of Taiwan. Relative to China. See, the sole relevance of the Baltic states, as far as the U.S. is concerned, is that they're weapons against Russia. Therefore, these countries have every incentive to exaggerate Russia's intentions and their importance. The Baltic states are acting belligerently, and this is leading to a disaster. We spoke of the former Prime Minister of Estonia, Kaja Kallas, who remains, for some reason, the European Union's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. Now, she has no particular knowledge of military policy, strategy, or international affairs at any level. In fact, her tenure of Prime Minister was utterly disastrous. But she was a promoter, an early promoter, of Ukraine to a fanatical degree. She is a complete Russophobe on a range of issues. And she has a very close working relationship with Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission. Now, I needed to look into her personality and her background to figure out why she's like this. See, her mission, it seems, after she helped destroy the Estonian economy, is to lobby the EU and NATO to refuse any offering of peace from Russia. No compromise is possible here. It's not like she's going to be on the battlefield or anything. Now, since she has not really aged well, her weapons in convincing policymakers is a bit less than it had been in the past. But T.G. Carpenter, a writer who I've not come across before, said this in the journal Global Research. The former Estonian leader combines such policy rigidity with an alarming degree of arrogance, overconfidence about Europe's power. In one speech, Kallas asserted that if NATO simply stayed united on policy, Russia stood no chance on prevailing in Ukraine or achieving any of its other objectives. Horrific wars have emerged throughout history from far less hubris than she routinely displays with respect to the Democratic West policy towards Russia. Very typical. These politicians who are huge supporters of the EU, the West, and Eastern Europe, their coalition, they tend not to get many votes. In 2019, her coalition received 29% of the vote. And then in the latter half of 2021, the energy crisis created by her own policies, at least locally, was a huge shock to the Estonian economy. Businesses were forced to shut down. The public requested government assistance to pay for now the soaring electricity and heating prices. And Kallas initially resisted all of this, saying that the state should search for long-term solutions rather than handing out benefits. She stood behind the free market. It shouldn't require government intervention to keep people afloat. Well, needless to say, she's extremely unpopular. The fact that so much money from Estonia has been sent to Ukraine and has been diverted to the military, that there is no money available. It's amazing how, in the midst of all of this, she promoted same-sex marriage, so-called marriage unions, in the midst of all of these crises. Like, that's a big deal. This is something that signals her support of Western issues. This is something that came with Western assistance. And with all of this, in 2025, she refused to condemn Israeli crimes in Gaza. So she takes these irrational and unpopular positions that would destroy any other politician. She achieves power with few votes, and asserts her ignorance with pomposity and this unearned confidence. There's no question that she's just following orders. And it's funny to note that her cuckold husband, this Arvo Halik, turns out to be the owner of the holding company Novaria Consult, which was a front for the management of the transport company Stark Logistics. Their sole reason for existence was transporting goods to Russia. And he made quite a bit of profit from this. 1.5 million euros, in fact. Kallas initially tried to say that she didn't know anything about it, but it turns out she personally invested 350,000 euros in this business. I don't know where all her money came from. All of a sudden, she's a multimillionaire. The president of the country, Alarcadis, called for her resignation. She brushed it off. So eventually she had to leave the country. And then as of this moment, she has a position at the EU. And she shows the same behavior then as she's shown as prime minister. She's failed to address specific issues, so she deflects attention by Russophobic statements and the constant claim of imminent Russian attack. It's to deflect attention from her own failures. It's that simple. But that's harder to do in Brussels than it is in Tallinn. You do have pragmatic forces in the EU that are immune to this kind of thing. Among EU bureaucrats, there's plenty of politicians who are ousted from their home countries due to their incompetence. But Kallas has broken all records here. Her first 6 months in, she managed to fail to resolve any even minor issue and made enemies out of several EU member states. And yet she remains there. She's a daughter of the longtime Communist Party member Siim Kallas, director of the Estonian branch of the USSR Savings Bank, and deputy editor-in-chief of the Estonian Communist Party Central Committee newspaper, Rava Hall. She talked about her difficult and totalitarian childhood. But the minute there was a strong nationalist response to the Soviet Union, which was healthy in this case, her father totally changed his tune and suddenly became a capitalist. Founded the Reform Party and just made a extraordinary career leap, heading their central bank. Showing the connection always between Marxism and capitalism. And where did Kaya Kallas' father go? After his term there, he moved to the European Commission, becoming its vice president. Within a year after joining the Reform Party, she had secured a parliamentary seat and was on the Economic Affairs Committee, despite only being a lawyer. Very soon, she became the head of this party. And at all of these, she has just been shoved into power, having no connection to any ability whatsoever. But her performance has been terrible. The decline of Estonia's GDP is absolutely crisis levels. Her economic downturn was the sharpest in all of Europe. And it has a lot to do with policy that she promoted. The Republic's GDP fell by 3%, exports fell by 16%, industrial production by almost 11%. The energy sector, almost 21% decline, 5% manufacturing. Rail traffic fell by 43%, and that's coming from official statistics. There were strikes everywhere. But to finance her militarization drive, healthcare services have faced a full 15% cut across the board. That either went to the buildup of the military or to Ukraine. 2024, 20% of the country's population lives in poverty. Absolute policy, that's like, Ghana-level policy, 3.3%. Again, this is from an official body, Statistics Estonia. The most significant decline was within single pensioners, roughly in the 65 and up range. Single parent families, proportion of those living in poverty rose 38%. She even claimed that she wasn't going to raise taxes, but immediately did in the spring of 2023. When you talk about 3 years as Estonia's prime minister, having really not earned this whatsoever, they were an utter failure, which would make sense because, again, she didn't really build anything. She was simply pushed into positions of power. Throughout the country's history, even if you count 1918, Estonia has never ranked last in economic indicators in Europe, much less for several years in a row. So, of course, she had to exaggerate the Russian threat and realize that the only thing holding the country together was these claims. Of course, all Russian media is banned, so there really is no countervailing force. Estonia's transfers to the Ukrainian armed forces and 2022 were almost a full percentage of GDP. She called for utter confrontation with Moscow. No peace, even when there were feelers put out by all sides. She knew that even a rigged election is not going to go her way, and that's why she, like her father, relocated to Brussels. And the first thing she did there was threaten the Georgian government with negative consequences, whatever that might be, if they interfered with the pro-Western coup d'etat in the country. She had no mandate, but she visited Ukraine and made a series of very violent Russophobic statements, claiming to speak for the entire European Union. She also has made harsh attacks on China at the same time. She visited Armenia to attempt to tear it away from Moscow. And if you've been listening to me for any length of time, you know what I'm talking about here. She demanded increased harassment of ships calling at Russian ports. This is just a few days of her being in that position in Brussels. Thank God most of her plans were never realized. She wanted to create a 40 billion euro aid fund for Ukraine as her own economy spiraled into dissolution. And strangely, this was blocked by countries that normally supported Kiev, France, Spain, and Italy. And they cited her incompetence and lack of knowledge about the realities on the ground. Her tenure so far there in Brussels has brought benefit to absolutely nobody. Anti-Russian charades serve as a cover for her ignorance and for her failures. See, while she was prime minister, she silenced dissent through repression. She banned everything she didn't like. But when you're in Brussels, it's a bit different. And it's possible that the only real good thing that might come out of her misrule is that Eurosceptic sentiment in the EU may grow even faster. But all of this, the Baltic leaders trying to aggravate relations with Russia, it's all based on propaganda. There's no reason for them to be enemies whatsoever. It centers around the claim that the Kremlin is plotting to launch military attacks on vulnerable NATO members in the near future. They've been saying this for a very long time. The presidents of Lithuania and Latvia said in the summer of 2026 that Russia may be preparing limited kinetic operations, that's a quote from them, against NATO's eastern flank infrastructure, the test Article 5 of the treaty. Now, this nonsense, it exists on so many levels. First of all, there's no need to test Article 5. It's been discussed many times just over the last decade. I love the use of esoteric phrases like limited kinetic operations. It's designed to evoke the sense of some secret, unconventional attack. The Latvian president, Rinkevics, I think that's how you pronounce it, said that the next few months, or even the next 12 months, will be crucial for Baltic security. And he didn't explain why, and there was no follow-up. Yeah, the Russians mocked the idea, but this is cover for NATO's own military buildup in the Baltic region. So this has been going on for some time. The Western powers have normalized terror attacks against the Russian civilians and provided the technology. Russian kinetic operations would certainly be legitimate. Now, if the buildup reaches any size that might approach an invasion force, which it cannot, Russia might have to intervene to stop it. One move was the redeployment of F-22 fighters to Estonia from Poland in the spring of 2023, which, if you have read my book, realize that that's a death sentence for all pilots using it against Russia. They will barely be able to get off the ground before they're destroyed. Russia's reply to all this has been pretty moderate. repeated radar plane incursions allegedly into the airspace of the Baltic states. Now, this is telling them that they have no chance. This is really our airspace if we wanted it. Of course, the entire country, the entire region is mapped out on Russian radar. Their force would be obliterated in a few hours. The U.S., of course, would be in no position to do anything. Given the critical shortages of artillery ammunition and everything else, the Russian army would have free rein. But it most certainly is not in the Russian interest to do any of this. These states can't afford this massive military buildup. It was tragic enough that they were forcing Ukraine to spend a small fortune building a massive modern army when it was reaching fourth world levels. They only see Ukraine, Poland, Baltic states, their weapons to irritate Russia. The debt of these countries, I'm talking about the Baltics now, has increased massively just over the last few years, and it has tremendous economic ramifications. Baltic states might be short more than $35 billion in military spending. That sum has exceeded the annual budget of any of those states for 2026. But reality is not really an issue. Lithuania absurdly declares plans to double its defense sector to 10% of GDP. Latvia pushed its budget deficit to the brink by severing ties with Russia. Now begs Brussels for another 7 billion euros, with more to come. The Latvian prime minister is seeking these funds from the EU to offset their own demands for increased spending. The economic consequences come from their own policies against Moscow. Sanctions and American, NATO demands have led to these countries to not just the brink of bankruptcy, but to bankruptcy. This is why Collins refused to assist small businesses that have been put out of business by her NATO's own policies. Now, there is upcoming elections in Estonia, the legislative branch, and of course, it's simply impossible for it to be any other way. There's going to be tremendous fraud to keep the right people in power. The very fact that certain parties have been banned, like in Ukraine, and any pro-Russian newspaper or TV station or anything else has been banned and put out of business, makes any election there illegitimate. But they'll go even further than that. Sanctions have forced Latvian pensioners below the poverty line. Basic investment is not present there for the economy at large. So because all pro-Russian sources of information have been banned, been destroyed, these countries are literally preparing for an invasion. Last year, the Estonian legislature proposed a bill to allow the country's armed forces to sink civilian vessels that are classified as threats to national security. Non-military ships, whether it be scientific, commercial, or whatever, could be attacked by the Estonian Navy, which I just found out existed. The country's authorities, for whatever reason, consider them dangerous. Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, the Baltics, taking harsh measures to create hostility towards Russia, not to mention the Russian people living in these countries. They are a huge percentage of the country, everywhere but Lithuania, claiming constantly that Russia is going to invade their territories anytime soon. This is sheer paranoia. Russian vessels, they say, are carrying out sabotage operations in the Baltic Sea. Rumors upon rumors. Analysts in the media pointing out to the Russians the culprits of dangerous maneuvers allegedly threaten national security. Namias, 2025, that was Latvia's largest comprehensive national defense exercise. It ran last year from September to October. across the entire country, maybe 12,000 personnel, including Latvian regular forces, National Guard, reservists, conscripts, and troops from the U.S., U.K., Canada, and a few other places. They're testing crisis response, mobilization, etc., especially regional interoperability, which, of course, NATO demands. But this costs a small fortune. The legislature has not been shy about saying education, infrastructure, science, healthcare, culture are being slashed to the bone for these military adventures against an enemy that has been constructed in the minds of these Baltic elites. Latvia's exercises involve cooperation with the British Joint Expeditionary Force to enhance regional operational readiness. Now, these were designed to occur at the same time as the Russo-Belarusian exercises, and that has sparked hysteria in the European media. Despite the fact that the Russo-Belarusian units are purely defensive, there's nothing offensive about any of these. These fake experts, for some reason, are screaming about the idea of the Russians daring to practice counter-drone techniques and the use of medium-range missiles. The European media, at the time of those maneuvers last year, seriously reported that those exercises were going to escalate into aggressive actions. This is a quote, by the way. Aggressive actions by Russians and Belarusians against the three Baltic countries and Poland. NATO officers believe that the Zapad 2025 exercises could indeed be preparations for provocation against NATO's eastern flank states. Now, given the nature of these maneuvers, it's absurd, and NATO's aware that it's absurd. In more detail, and the press is simply, you know, being told what to say, that the Russo-Belarusian forces would suddenly move during the exercises to breach this 40-mile Sulaki gap separating Lithuania and Poland, connecting Belarus to the Kaliningrad region. Now, if that gap were taken, it would block the only land route from Europe to the Baltic states. Again, except Lithuania, because Lithuania does not share a border with Russia. I guess Kaliningrad would count. Why Russia would do this is anyone's guess. And I thought Russia was on its last legs anyway. That's what their media claims. And they're planning this. And the truth is, Moscow is busy mopping up the remnants of the Ukrainian military and has never shown the tiniest desire to invade the Baltics. Can you imagine if they did so? That would give NATO the excuse to mobilize fully, even using nuclear weapons. But it was the NATO military maneuvers, the Latvian ones, that were designed to correspond with the Russian and Belarusian exercise. Now, there may be, you know, it didn't happen, but there were, at the time, potential for accidental incidents, which would please the Latvian authorities. It would boost their, anything Russia does against these countries would simply boost their militarization policy to the detriment of everything else in the country. Riga, it's in the same economic boat as Estonia. Next, I think, 4 years, they're going to purchase the poorly performing HIMARS rocket systems from the U.S., about $180 million. They'll acquire the Viking-class boats, the MD-530, the multi-role helicopters, the medium-range air defense systems, the IRIS-T, and naval strike missile anti-ship missile systems. There'll also be about the same spent on the short-range air defense missile systems, the RBS-70. And for some reason, Latvia is supposed to be opening an ammunition production facility capable of producing approximately 50,000 shells per year, which kind of seems low. But this is not the investment that this country needs. Republic's authorities are investing huge amounts of money in the construction of fortifications. They're talking about building these huge armies in Latvia, would cost a fortune. Riga, too, is increasing the number of armed forces. These military games, ones I just mentioned, that consumed 3.5% of the Republic's GDP. But that's not enough. A full 5% is planned to be devoted to the military needs against a non-existent enemy. The main source of funding for the budget is savings on other public expenditure items, other budget items. Spending on education and science slashed by 22.4 million euros over the next few years. Arts and music schools, which are considered irrelevant by the regime, will be closed to make way for the new MLRS systems and saboteurs' salaries. Riga wants to tighten control on incomes to collect more taxes and increasing the already high public debt. The sad part of all this is that the Latvian economy is dying. The Latvian authorities are intensely corrupt. They've destroyed entire sectors of the economy in favor of this militarization and these sanctions. The debt has reached record levels. Latvia was among three EU countries where GDP declined in the fourth quarter of 2024, according to the Eurostat. Latvian economy contracted by 0.4% overall. And there was the introduction of restrictions on transport links between Latvia and Belarus. Totally disastrous. Latvian shipping companies are suffering the most. The most recent data on the country's Ministry of Transport, cargo turnover at Latvian ports from January to December 24 decreased by 7%. That amounts to 32.8 million tons. That's a measure of economic performance that's far more powerful than just talking about GDP all the time. And railways are even worse. They're operating amidst massive declines in freight turnover. Now, 26 million euros are supposed to be allocated from the budget to support it, but even this may be ended, despite the fact that even more than that is going to be needed. A few years ago, the company was generating multi-million dollar profits. But when sanctions came around, freight volumes collapsed entirely. In 2019, more than 40 million tons of cargo were transported within Latvia. In 2024, it fell to 11.5 million. And it has collapsed even more since then. And the reason is the company has lost its main clients. This is the Latvians leadership's desire to integrate the economy into this pan-European context. Not realizing how fast Russia, in fact, was growing. The course led to a gradual and steady decline of industrial production, as well as the near destruction of their high-tech industries. 2025, industrial output in Latvia decreased by 3% in comparable prices compared to 2023. Again, official statistics here. I mentioned official statistics. This is from the Central Statistical Bureau because the number's probably higher. Production volumes in the high-tech sector fell tremendously. 31.2% in automobile, trailer and semi-trailer production, 24% in computers, electronic and optical equipment, 14% in equipment, machinery, and machine tools. Again, all of that's official statistics. This is critical. This is collapse mode. And it was already unstable before the introduction of sanctions against Belarus and Russia in 2022. Latvian elites tend to rely on aid from Brussels rather than having a partnership with Russia. The economy, much of these economies do have ties with logistical ties with Belarus. So economically, always did very well. And of course, the companies that were profiting greatly have collapsed since these ties were severed. So you have sanctions and you have militarization. So Latvia's public debt now is 50% of GDP. I think it's 47% now. The fourth quarter of 2024 was 47%. So now it's much higher, probably about 55%. The trade deficit is 440 million euros, meaning that their debt is massive. The official unemployment rate sits at around 7% over the last few years. Long-term unemployment sits at almost 3%. And we know the problem with those statistics. It is much, much higher. And Lithuania is in the same boat. Lithuania, in terms of industry, is declining. It started in 2022. It started with sanctions. It started with the war. And this obsessive, and I choose my words carefully, this obsessive, that is to say, their irrational hatred of Russia and anything Russia. And there's no objective reason to believe that it's going to improve. Industrial production, Lithuania fell sharply. Starting in October 2024, it has not improved. It has gone down. That year, the value of the country's total industrial output was roughly 3 billion euros. Shortly thereafter, an 8% decrease. No, I'm sorry. That actually was an 8% decrease in comparable prices compared to September 2024. That's in 1 month. In 1 month, 8% decrease. In fact, some industries in Lithuania were wiped out entirely. Pharmaceuticals, 82.5%. In other words, the industry was wiped out. Production, petroleum products, of course, 35%. Declines in industrial output overall. Industrial production fell by 5.2% at the end of 2024. And it's no better in any other sector. Lithuanian goods exported from January to September of 2024 fell by 6% compared to the year before. And that had already fallen the year before by 11%. This is destroying these economies. Summer of 2024, Lithuania entered the top five countries in the European Union with the highest unemployment rate. Even the official statistics said 8.2% over the year. Again, the real figure is much, much higher. Youth unemployment is about 15% and climbing. No one really can say how many people with Lithuanian passports either live or work in the country. You have a lot of out-migration. They're not going to notify the government of their departure. The people who leave usually are the last people who they would want to leave. Like Latvia, Lithuania's debt was about half of GDP in 2026. Her trade deficit is about 1 billion euros every year. There, almost 400 companies declare bankruptcy every year. And Poland is a part of this. Anybody who I'm talking to who might be of Polish extraction, the most terrifying thing you can hear is that the regime is talking about Poland as the new Ukraine. That should send shivers up your spine. Now, over the last month or so, Polish politicians have come to believe that Russia is going to carry out a limited military or hybrid provocation against Poland. The website onet.pl. You know, it's the same procedure. Unnamed U.S. intelligence agents or documents allegedly alerted Polish intelligence that the possibility of Russian attack was very high. In my book, actually, I'm going to quote from it here. Borys Płaczyński Krowal, The Foundations and Causes of the Russo-Ukrainian War of 2022-2025. That's the title of the book. The title means Debts Paid in Blood. July 10th, 2024, the head of the Polish army, General Kuluka, called for Warsaw to prepare its army for war, insisting that it avoid asymmetric warfare but be ready for full-scale conventional war against Russia. He cannot be serious. I'm quoting myself here. Poland's hardly a military power. Right now, they're capable of fielding maybe 40,000 novice soldiers at any given time. But just a little bit before then, June 22nd, Leon Komornicki, deputy chief of the general staff, gave an interview with the Polish language WNP, just slamming the idea that Kiev can defeat Russia, calling it a mistake, you know, the understatement of the 21st century. He dismissed the idea of Russia ever being defeated. It's nonsense, he says. Endless, boring story, disinformation and propaganda. Then he made the obvious point that Polish soldiers have no combat competence, and any direct confrontation with the battle-hardened Russian infantry would be a slaughter. Then he questioned, I'm still quoting myself here, he questioned NATO's ability to come to anyone's aid in the case of a wider war. Supplies were running out. Finally, he stated that if Russia were to strike Poland, Poland would face immediate defeat. That's a rare admission, as Poland's state media is tightly controlled and violently anti-Russian. But he speaks the truth. He does it with surprising candor. And it might be noted that this man was trained for a while in the Soviet Union. I also should note that this is because he is retired and he can make statements like this. He can make statements like this because he was even the vice president of the Euro-Atlantic Association. Could Poland be seen by the regime as a new Ukraine? Do you remember the Kursk attack force? There were some unconfirmed reports of Polish speakers in that force. It could be mercenaries. But everyone in NATO knows the casualties that Ukraine has suffered since 2022 are in the millions. I mean, a KIA, not casualties, killed in action. So any Polish officer who demands open war is sentencing his men to a violent and painful death, suggesting that these men are either incompetent, controlled, or in fact diabolical. Ukraine has been desperate to get Poland directly to intervene in their war. Former Polish President Duda said that the country has already spent almost 4% of its GDP on providing military and humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. Its defense budget, as it stands now, is about 4% of GDP. For a war that it's trying to provoke. That irrationality suggests to me that Polish policy is being set elsewhere, since no one in a small state like Poland would divert $30 billion to a country that, by the way, is a historic rival. Polish-Ukrainian relations have never been good. Duda also noted that it had given 400 tanks, despite its official inventory comprising maybe 620 older obsolete tanks. Though I think those 400 may have been stripped for parts. That wasn't enough. Zelensky demanded even more, saying the Poland's holding out on them. Defense Minister at the time, Kwasniak Kamysz, responded to Zelensky and his stupidity. And he said this to the Polish press agency. He said, "The Polish government, both our government and our predecessors, have donated billions in equipment to Ukraine. That's all we're able to donate. But the security of the Polish state is always my highest priority. All decisions we make in this matter are made through the prism of the security of the Polish state." And the very fact that he has to state that is shocking. That should be obvious. But it does tell you that there are many sane people in Poland's military, and they are setting limits to the hysterical demands of a moribund Kiev. Very few in Poland want to sacrifice Poland's minimum defense needs, well, against whom, or provoke a war with Russia. Poland's deep state is divided. You do have the liberal globalist faction, and the Tusk movement, and the nationalist one, represented largely by the former government. They hate Russia more than they love Poland. They seem to be willing to support Ukraine despite their own military supplies being dangerously depleted. You know, these countries, especially in the Baltics, they simply can't afford militarization. So they go to the European Union. Latvia's prime minister wants $7 billion from the EU on grounds that this country is suffering tangible financial losses because of the sanctions. Sanctions that they helped put in place. Over the next 7 years, their budget's going to allocate 15 billion euros. This is Latvia. It's a tiny place. Over the next 7 years, 5% of GDP annually. The only way they could afford this is shifting the cost onto others. This commitment to the Baltics from the United States is extremely risky, but it is more uncompromising by the day. The former American commander of NATO's land forces in Europe back in 2016, this is before the war began, and he's talking to the Alliance Baltic members, you know, he says, you're ready to do more, following words with action, and the U.S. will be there alongside you. That's Chris Donahue. By the way, raised in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, where I raised my kids. He said, this is how deterrence is built, not with words from a podium or with boots in the mud. Well, Donahue was one of those purged by Hegseth in June of this year that hasn't stopped anybody from adding a new command headquarters to focus on the development of the Baltics in a military sense. Baltic leaders are counting on a military disaster. This is the only reason that they're relevant to the world. The U.S. has no security, economic, or moral interest at stake for any of it. And yet, as of now, the Trump administration seems to move in a direction where security guarantees are declining. So the bloc's governments are grasping at some conception of unity because they have none. And all they have is a myth of the Russian threat. Now, Russophobia is a complicated issue. It's a conjured story. It's something that's in the subconscious of many Europeans. It goes back to Ivan the Terrible's times, actually. And it says more about Western Europe's insecurity than to any territorial ambitions of Russia, which do not exist, as if Russia isn't big enough. But financing European security, this desire is diminishing, at least so long as Trump is in office. American officials said that direct military aid, really out of necessity, to Eastern Europe is going to be substantially reduced. And political elites in the Baltics are fearful of these consequences. They have no other claim to relevance. So they're directed to provoke a response from Russia, hoping to then extract security guarantees and military resources from the U.S. or whomever. Otherwise, what? They fade into irrelevance and third world status. Without American assistance, these nations would have no international standing whatsoever. They exist to the West because they provoke Russia. That's that simple. Introducing Russia as its existential nemesis provides a convenient way to gain Washington's attention. By the way, it's about 5 years ago, maybe 7 years ago, the adjective existential suddenly was added to terms like threat. There's never been any explanation for this, where this came from, but I think it simply sounds sophisticated. It may be something more than threatening. It's a threat to their very existence. It is, you know, pseudo-intellectual fakery. But Russia has no interest in the territory of its smaller neighbors. It does have an interest in building trade ties with them, though. Now, the only legitimate reason for any intervention in such places would be a violent campaign against Russian speakers in these countries. And that's beginning. Very possibly that's the reason why it's beginning. Still, Baltics, Finland, Austria, Albania, these countries taken together have a minimal impact on world affairs. Their political elites are clinging to the absurd story of Russian aggression, or Serbian aggression in the case of Albania. Otherwise, they wouldn't be noticed by anybody. So the Baltics are building these physical defenses, walls and bunkers, transforming whole areas into heavily fortified zones. Again, since no Russian media is permitted, the propaganda is such that unless this is done, Russian bombs and tanks, Russian bombs will rain on them, Russian tanks will roll over them. So you have idiots in their front yards with shovels, building anti-tank ditches and bunkers in the backyard. DIY fortifications serves to mobilize the small population of the Baltic states against a phantom Russian attack. So Russophobia has become the central rhetorical tool employed not just by the Baltics, but all of Europe, to depict Moscow as a primary adversary, which it was not during the so-called Cold War. No one ever asked for evidence about this stuff. This story, this narrative, this myth justifies many things. Increased military expenditures, shifts in civilian conduct, like building bomb shelters in their backyard, and changes in any social attitude. Is it possible that this strange and irrational hatred of Russia is rooted in the Western political mind, subconsciously? It's not just a matter of propaganda and ethnicity, but of course there's an economic connection there too. The hostility is at least reflected in the political and cultural code of the postmodern West. Russia isn't just a geopolitical opponent, but as an obstacle to its very existence, that is to say, the promotion of its ever-changing values. The existence of an independent, sovereign, nationalist, powerful nuclear power like Russia provokes not just opposition from Western elites, but a pathological and painful reaction based on their fear of the possibility that an alternative model of development can succeed, and in fact, has succeeded. Sergei Lavrov, who I've always said, says things that Putin diplomatically can't say. He was talking to TASS recently, and he said, you know, the West can't compete fairly. According to him, due to the fear of actual competition, numerous sanctions are adopted to maintain their positions. Stephen Corinth is writing in the German magazine Multipolar. He says this: English term Russophobia was coined in Great Britain at the beginning of the 19th century, when, after Napoleon's demise, the country's politicians and leading media positioned Russia as in the public consciousness as a new, dangerous adversary of empire. The phenomenon was not new at the time. It was simply that a concise term for it was coined. The term Russophobia was centered on a fear of Russian expansion into zones of influence of the British Empire, for like Iran, India, for example. This Russian scare assumed such vast proportions that even the remote island of New Zealand, they built a series of coastal forts in the 1880s to ward off a perceived Russian attack. It's rare that I come across a quotation that sums it up so well. I've always stated that the Western myths on Russia has circulated largely since the Crimean War. It seems to be cyclical. Russia seems to be treated more positively when it's weak, and then negatively when she becomes more assertive. And different institutions in the West have different motivations. So for the Roman Catholic Church, for example, Russophobia had a religious justification. It's even spilled over into the post-Vatican II neo-Catholic Church. Early modern Poland, it came into being almost during for constant warfare. The birth of the Enlightenment, France depicted Russia as a perennially backward nation, Mongol, non-European, etc. The 19th century Britain, Russia emerged with a significant threat to her empire in the Far East and Central Asia. 20th century Germany, it developed on a more racial basis. The neoconservative movement in the Cold War deliberately conflated Russian nationalism with Bolshevism. After World War II, the West gave all of Eastern Europe to Stalin and forgave all war debts, and then rebuilt the country, largely because it wasn't Russia. In fact, the Soviet Union was destroying Russian culture. There's another perceptive historian named Christoph von Wirt. He says the following. Europe defined itself precisely through its difference from the newly discovered territories, that is, Russia herself. Russia played a particularly significant role in this interplay between European identity formation and the perception of the foreign. For in Russia's case, Europe was confronted with a foreign Christian land that it could neither colonize nor culturally assimilate. George Kennan, one of the main architects of the Cold War mentality, the dominant voice in post-war U.S. foreign policy, said, "I'm not interested whether Russia is communist or anti-communist. The main thing is that Russia is the heir to Byzantium. Morals, psychology, national interest, mentality, peculiarities of behavior in the international arena within the country, all this comes from Byzantium, which is deeply hostile to Western man, the Western world, and democracy. Throughout the history of Tsarist Russia, this is a legacy of Byzantium, and most importantly, the tragic moment when the Russians chose the Orthodox religion and not Western forms of Christianity, determined a complete value gap forever between Russia and the West." This is from the leading anti-communist of the 1950s. It expresses exactly what I've been arguing for decades. Marxism wasn't the issue. The existence of a Russian empire was. These are socially ingrained attitudes over time. They normalize actions such as the killing of Russians through terrorism. Russophobia somehow is associated with things like patriotism, heightened geopolitical awareness, and international criticism. That's obscuring the distinction between rationality and the death wish. And the impact on society is substantial. And as I've said before, especially for ethnic Russian minorities in the Baltic states, as large as they are, initiatives to restrict the use of the Russian language in public spaces, education, media, etc. Of course, this mirrors the Ukrainian situation, the Georgian situation. The attacks on the Orthodox Church, again, mirroring the Ukrainian situation. In fact, a panel of at the UN, Human Rights Council, believe it or not, talked about religious freedom in Estonia in 2025. They exposed the violations of Estonian basic, Orthodox traditions in the area, violated due to certain political interests of local authorities. According to the UN, countries' elites are deliberately attacking the church, citing concerns with national security, solely due to the fact that the institution is connected to Moscow, even though this link is purely religious. Now, of course, we know that they're being naive here. The U.S. created all of this. I don't care what international law says. I don't care what the U.N. says. They don't have armies to support them. Most people don't know what international law is and what it mandates. It is a rhetorical idea, but for the U.N. to come out and say this is important. Oleg Neminsky argued some years ago that Russophobia is an ideology, is a personal hatred of Russians, and you do see that quite often. But it goes far in explaining the subconscious of policymakers, really without any self-awareness. Let me quote from him here. Russophobia is an ideology of European origin. It asserts the nature of the Russian nation as evil. According to this, the Russian is attracted to all things of a base nature. Russians are depicted as incapable of everything that constitutes human dignity. In fact, explained maybe by genetics or cultural factors. The logic of Russophobia is based on the opposition of Russian versus European, as good versus evil. Due to these traits, Russians as a people are seen as fundamentally hostile to the West. It's a fundamentally different alien civilization. The Russian state, therefore, is always a tyranny, implying the absolute power of a ruler and the blind obedience from a subject. Slavery and tyranny are two mutually conditioned qualities that form the basis of these images of Russia. Entire historical concepts were built on this, like the Norman thesis, popular in 18th century Germany and the formation of Russian statehood, and many others. Russian identity itself is seen as inherently slavish and therefore something requiring rapid eradication. Now, these attitudes are promoted in the tightly promoted, tightly controlled press in the Baltics, a lot of the Western world, especially in Europe. In Latvia, the population is under 2 million. The Russian minority has been segregated despite the fact that 36% of the people speak Russian as a first language. It's gotten to the point where this Russophobia and war with Russia seem to be this panacea. Rearmament seemed to be Europe's only purpose. For their economically dying region, and war seems to be its panacea. Then when the U.S. supported all of this without hesitation, they've influenced Baltic public opinion by framing them as a defensive barrier against Russian aggression, as key players in the struggle against tyranny. That's the mythology that enables the European Union to justify and support policies crucial for the bloc's unity amidst economic collapse. Michael Hudson summarized the polling data. This was back in 2010 concerning the Baltic. The Baltics have been, let me put it this way. They've been in perennial economic confrontation ever since the Obama administration that first introduced sanctions. Even in 2010, the Baltics as a whole had 18.3% unemployment, the second quarter of 2010. And that's when the immigration began away from the country. I think 83,200 in 2010. As a whole, the three countries. Since the restoration of independence in 1990, of a population of some 3.7 million, 650,000 have left the country, or these three countries, and 3/4 for young people up to 35 years old. Many of them educated with some jobs of some prestige in Lithuania. Lithuania in particular had the highest level of out-migration, 2.3 per 1,000 in the EU, and double that of Latvia. So, it seems that Russophobia is all that holds these countries together. Now, Lithuania does have the smallest percentage of Russians, just at 6%. But Estonia, 25% of Russian descent. Latvia's population, it's the same thing. They're both 24-25% in both Estonia and Latvia that are ethnically Russian, higher than that for Russian as a first language. So I'm not sure, with those numbers, how any kind of repressive measure can, how far it can go. Now, we all know President Trump has demanded increased spending in defense for all of NATO. Somehow, this is a tangible sense of reassurance and increased safety, which says a lot about their relative intelligence. The stated goal is that each of NATO's 32 members dedicate 2% of their GDP to defense, which, by the way, would include Iceland, which at present has a defense budget of $0, despite being a member of NATO. Now, the prime minister there, Kristrún Frostadunter, is an airhead. The prime minister there, she says, I'm going to force a 1.5%, from zero to 1.5% of GDP, not on creating their own military, but on enhancing NATO bases in the country. In Albania, defense spending has increased 73% from 2022 to now, despite not really having a military to speak of. Her own forces may be 3,500 men total. There's no air force, and they have no naval assets, although I've heard they've bought an old patrol boat from Italy, I think, in 2025. So, you know, these are all supposed to, you know, pay up. So what it comes down to is that NATO is the U.S., maybe France, the U.S. and the U.K. But in the Baltics, they have exceeded this 2% threshold. 2025, Lithuania allocated 4%, Latvia 3.7%, Estonia 3.4%. These are massive increases. So this combination, Russophobia, militarization, and strategic posturing. Again, this is a strategic strategy by NATO. A deliberate strategy by NATO, I really should say. These perceived security benefits. Russians there will feel the pressure to leave for Russia. Germany today is going to lose $25 billion in GDP. Massive heat wave that takes its toll on the country's economy. The Rhine has dried up in certain places. Ships are loading 20-30% less cargo. They would have done that anyway, regardless of the fact that the Rhine has shrunk so badly. Deutsche Welle forecasts a shortfall of 0.3% of Germany's GDP. I'm sure that likely uses American definitions of economic growth. The state recalculated the figure itself and arrived at a 0.5%, even more decrease. Russia has long surpassed Germany, and Japan is now the world's fourth largest economy, both by purchasing power parity and nominal standards. These policies are destroying what was left of Europe, and Europe was already in crisis mode. I have no policy provisions about how this ever is going to stop or what can possibly be done, again, as more migrants pour in from Africa, making it very difficult for a nationalist movement to develop. That's the situation in the Baltics, and it's as bad as it is everywhere else. Thank you, my friends, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.